Most of us learn about the activities of the criminal underworld from a safe distance, I guess, reading about it in the papers and hearing about it in the radio and TV. So what is it like to confront that world close up and to report on some of these very, very dangerous and volatile Irish criminals? Well, Nicola Tallant is investigations editor of the Sunday World, and she's been doing just that for years now, and she joins me in studio this morning. You're welcome, Nicola.
Thank you, Brendan.
Nicola, we see people marching in Drogheda today. I think people seem to feel that the last few weeks we have seen a new level of viciousness in gangland. Do you think that's true?
Oh, I think we have. There's no doubt about it. The dismemberment of that teenager's body and the fact that it was done for it to be displayed is absolutely, we've never seen anything like that before. There have been, you know, dismemberments of bodies within murders, but they would always have been to hide the identity of the victim, maybe, or to hide who'd done it. So this is just, I mean, you know, we don't even hear about this very much Europe-wide. This story has actually been international news, not just local news, you know. It was reported all over the UK and beyond. And you know, when something like that happens, when the reporting goes beyond our own country, that it is really, really serious and different.
And what's going on here? Is it a generational thing, like that there's just a new generation coming up who are more vicious? Or
that's a frightening thought. There have always been violent people in that world, always. You know, you can look back and find psychopaths who did horrible things, but the new generation seem to always go first to a gun or to violence to settle any dispute. Whereas before, there might have been a place where they would sit down at a table and, you know, be more businesslike about things.
Okay.
There's a huge amount of firearms in this country. There's a massive amount of drug use. And there was a very interesting report there during the week that indicates that possibly when somebody has sociopathic tendencies, if they take cocaine, it has a really, really bad effect on them and, you know, creates this huge violence within them.
So that begs two questions. You've presumably you've been watching a lot of these guys and you've rubbed up against them in various ways. Do you think that is being a sociopath, is that part of what's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, do you know, I was only thinking about this recently, like, you know, people talk about, are you born that way or does the environment create you? And if you think of living in that world and you know, you see things and things become the norm. And I mean, even as a society, we've got used to shootings. I mean, now that this murder has happened, we're kind of nearly seeing an assassination as a clean murder rather than, you know, this one, which has horrified us. So you get used to things. And I do wonder that if they're living so long within that world, do they become sociopathic? Is that possible? That all feeling goes and, you know, things happen to them and they do things. And, you know, do your feelings and your morals die when you're living within that world?
So does the word evil cross your mind? Are some of these people actually evil?
Yeah, I would certainly think so. And, you know, there are certain individuals that they would look at you and their eyes are like a shark. I mean, there's nothing there. There's nothing in behind them. It's as if their soul has died. And you can kind of just sense that or feel it from them.
And then on the cocaine issue. So obviously, we've heard a lot of talk about a lot of other people taking cocaine and how that's feeding all this and everything. Are these guys increasingly also on cocaine themselves when they're up to a lot of this stuff?
Very much so. I mean, I've actually spoken to some of the guys who would be living within that world or who had been, perhaps. And, you know, they will tell you that they're eating it because they're just literally, they need it for the adrenaline to go out and do something like that. I suppose by human nature, you know, to drive yourself up to do a robbery or a shooting or whatever. They need that extra adrenaline and they take it and it becomes part of their daily life. And of course, it's there, isn't it? Because they're not actually having to go out and earn money to buy it. It all comes, you know, as part of the job, as being in that world. It's a little bonus for them to have it, bags of it, wherever they want it. But they are, I mean, they're taking a phenomenal amount of it. I mean, you could be talking, you know, I was talking to a chap recently who was saying he would easily take 20 lines in almost in one go. I mean, that's an enormous amount of cocaine.
That's heart attack territory. Yeah,
absolutely.
Imagine.
Yeah. Okay, so I suppose you get used to it and your tolerance goes up.
Yeah. And you talk about like their souls being dead, but I get that kind of use of cocaine over a long period is extremely corrosive on a person's soul as well, you'd imagine.
It is. Yeah. And then it drives this paranoia, which is really, you know, creates more tensions within that world, and they get paranoid that somebody's talking about them or talking to the guards. And there's been many people who have been shot dead because somebody got paranoid about them. I mean, even there was a chap there last year was murdered in the garden of a house while there was a wake going on. Hamid Sanambar was his name. And he was accused by his own of having had something to do with a double cross. But there doesn't seem to be any evidence he did. They just all were looking for somebody and got paranoid.
Okay. And the paranoid lighted on him. The other thing that I think has shocked people in recent weeks as well is that we've discovered a little bit more about how young some of these guys are. And we won't talk about specific kids who've been in the news, but the general culture here seems to be that they're getting younger and younger coming into this.
Definitely. And they would be, you know, you could have somebody, they're very ambitious, I suppose, the younger they are, and they see a little way of getting in or getting involved, and they will be very willing to do anything it takes. So they don't have any sense when they're young. None of us have. When you think of stuff, well, certainly when I think of stuff I did when I was a teenager, it chills me to the bone that I thought it was okay to do
and
it.
And of course, the adolescent brain is highly risk-taking, isn't it?
Indeed, it is. So, you know, and they're really wanting to make a name for themselves. They're really wanting to be seen as the maddest or the most violent or whatever. So they're the ones who are out doing the dirty work, and they're doing it for very little, you know. There's people sitting well above them in the pecking order who are just directing them on what to do. So they're very young. I mean,
and when you say they want to be known as the maddest and the most violent and everything, that's their narrative of success. They see like is that to have a reputation like that is what gives you status.
To be feared in that world is power, and that's what it's all about.
And there seems to be an aspect as well of wanting a certain kind of lifestyle that they see the older guys having.
Oh, most definitely. And certain clothing they want, and they want the cars, and they don't tend to want anything very, you know, they don't tend to want a house necessarily or something like that. Or everything is about big flash spending, flash holidays. The more money you can throw at a thing, the better. Big, huge watches on their arms. The Rolex watch, I'm sure Rolex would be delighted, is the absolute status symbol. You have arrived when you've one of those on your arm.
Okay.
They're just driven by, you know, an image.
And how then does a girl from Killiney end up being kind of attracted to reporting on this world? Was there journalism in your family?
There wasn't. This is where I find my spot on the wall, is it? And no, there was no journalism in my family. My father was a wine merchant. I don't know. I cannot remember where it came from.
A wine merchant. Is he appalled at how you ended up?
He would have found it amusing. Yeah, okay. Certainly. Yeah. And maybe, you know, I'm pretty appalled when I think of the business I could have gone into. It would have been quite pleasant. But yeah, I always wanted to be a journalist, absolutely, from as far back as I can remember when I was in school. I don't know really where it came from. I presume there might have been a bit of a Superman Lois Lane thing there somewhere along the way, although I can't distinctly remember that. But it was something I always wanted to do and I was very driven to do it.
And obviously a bit of an adrenaline junkie, because the first thing you wanted to be was a war reporter. You gave that a go.
Yeah, well, I don't know whether I gave it a go, but I certainly would have. That would have been something that would have attracted me. I never really wanted to do features or I don't know, report on politics. None of that interested me. I suppose maybe I am a bit of an adrenaline junkie. I like a little bit of danger, maybe. Yeah, I wanted to do war reporting. I did go to Albania at one point when I was working for the Daily Mirror, and I had some experience, but there was bombs going off, I remember, one day, and I nearly died. I got in under a table and I felt a bit...
Okay, and you decided this is a bit, I don't have the constitution for this.
I also was very glad when I was booked home on the last flight out of Albania, and it was business class, and I kind of thought, you know, I need a shower here. So I don't know whether I would have had the rough and readiness maybe for that.
And then I suppose it was when you went into the Sunday World, you established yourself as a crime journalist, and notwithstanding obviously the late Veronica Guerin, was there an element of that it was a boys club, and did you have to prove yourself a bit more as a woman in that role?
It's certainly a very male dominated world, there's no doubt about it. But I think for me, I growing up was never made to feel that I couldn't do anything because I was a woman. There was two of us, myself and my brother, and there was nothing that one could do that the other couldn't. I think that stands to me through life, and it's certainly, I've never felt that I don't belong in the world of crime journalism because I'm a woman. I've been a bit more determined to prove myself amongst my male peers, and I always want to be judged on my work rather than, you know, my gender.
Were you working as a crime correspondent when Veronica Guerin was murdered?
I was working as a correspondent for a UK newspaper, and I would have been on all the big stories of the day. And of course, that was the story. And in the years after it, when John Gilligan and his gang were brought into the Special Criminal Court, I was working on that. I think that was quite influential on my future job, I have to say.
Because I guess it would have scared a lot of people off.
I didn't feel scared by it, but it did kind of tap into, I suppose, my sense of justice and my sense of what was right and wrong. And certainly when I was sitting in the Special Criminal Court and John Gilligan was in the dock, there was I got a real feeling of, you know, this is good. It's good to see him sitting there, and he's lost all his power and his, you know, I mean, look, we were all so horrified by that murder. It was horrendous that somebody felt that they had become that powerful and that big in society that they could do that.
You've also had other high profile assignments where you've tracked down some of those other guys who people would know their names. Give us a few examples of that, and maybe explain to people how you plan a thing like that or how it works.
Yeah, I suppose the Sunday World, I suppose, as a newspaper, has always been a bit edgy and a bit in your face with its journalism, its crime journalism, and it's sort of a deeper dive maybe than the daily reporting. So you're also trying to get up close and personal, and not in a David Attenborough style way. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we like to get up close. We like to photograph people within where they are. So we've had a number of big assignments over the past few years, you know, over to Spain, right into the middle of that Kinahan cartel when they were based out there. We tracked down the Penguin where he was living in Germany. He had disappeared for 20 years, was working on the international scene, and he was a big hit. I've also continued to give John Gilligan a bit of a kicking whenever I can. He would be somebody that I like sometimes to see him getting this underworld treatment. So how do you plan a thing like that? Well, your first concern is your safety and your security and how you go about it. We always work in teams to try and photograph the likes of Christy Kinahan, who would be living in a, you know, surrounded by security. It's very difficult to get close to these people. So mm-hmm. you have to try and find the most opportune place. You have to consider your safety, you know, and doing something, if you're approaching them, doing it in public is better than going to a door or to an isolated home. You just gather as much intelligence about them as possible. And then you sort of... I used to always say it's a bit of luck, but Colin McGinty, my old editor, always said you make your own luck, you know. So, it's kind of like just to get as up close as possible.
And you talk about the safety in it. Do these guys view you as the enemy? Like, would they be mad enough to think that they might do anything to you? Or do you think that there is a kind of an understanding there that you are doing a job and that, you know, it would be crazy for them to do anything to you?
I think some of the older guys would just see me and my likes as a bit of a wasp. You're just annoying. And I think that if they sat back and thought about it, they probably would like to do something, but they probably would think it's not such a good idea. A lot of the older criminals remember when the power of the state came down on gangland after Veronica Guerin's murder and what happened, and they were scattered to the four corners of the world and their businesses were destroyed. So they would, I think, logic it out that it wasn't such a good idea. It's the younger guys that I'd have no doubt that if they got an opportunity, they would, you know, they would be capable of doing anything.
And have you had serious threats?
I suppose, anybody working in amongst that world, be you police, prison officers, even healthcare workers, solicitors, judges, yes, you can sometimes find yourself in the line of a threat. You know, a lot of stuff will come in, people will kick off, they'll shout or roar, they might ring in to the office. They're unlikely to follow through with it. More seriously is when... And a few journalists have been issued with what we call GIMS, their Garda information messages. That's when there has actually been intelligence gathered that there is a real threat to your life that somebody.
So the guards rang you up at some stage and said, "There's a."
I have had in the last few years. I did receive a GIM form, and it was to do with a big crime story, an international crime story, and a very serious organised crime gang. So, they phone you up and they tell you that there is a threat to your life, which is a little bit, a bit taken aback by that. I was phoned up and told that. And then the guards will come with the GIM form, which I had to sign to say I had read it. I understood. I got the message. Exactly. Yeah. Got security advice. It's a nightmare. And I'm sure anybody who has been in the position... You know, there was a guard, I think, mentioned in the papers this week who was followed home from Drogheda by some of these gang members will know what a nightmare it is. Your first concern is obviously for the security of your family.
Yeah.
And you have to change routine. You have to keep your head down a bit, watch your back and hope that it abates.
Do you live a bit like that all the time? Because, I mean, Dublin's a small place and presumably you want to go about and live your life and everything, but equally...
Yeah, I do a little bit. I probably am a bit odd and I don't even know it myself because I'm just so used to it. But I would be constantly looking around me because I personally think that the biggest risk I would have would be an opportunist who might be coming along the street and all of a sudden they see you and they decide, oh, I'll make a bit of a name for myself here. So I would be looking around. I don't go to certain places. I'd be choosy about where I would be out if I was out having a drink or a meal. I do like to sit in the seat that I can look out, across wherever I am with my back to the wall. I don't even think about it. I kind of just do that.
And have you come across guys in when you're out and about?
Yeah, I have. And, you know, look, some people can be disarmed by when you actually talk to them and they, you know, they're kind of taken aback that, you know, you'll actually speak to them.
Like, what would you say to them?
Well, just how are you doing? Or, you know, they'd come over. I was actually out for a drink one night and somebody approached me who I had written about, actually. And I couldn't just place him wherever he was, but he came over for a bit of trouble. But by the end of it, we had got chatting and...
Just tell me about that now. So what was his attitude coming over? What was he saying?
Well, he came over and stood in front of me and, you know, sort of put his arms out as in, here I am. And of course, it because it was so out of context, I sort of was looking at him quizzically, wondering, how do I know this guy? You know, was I in college with him, whatever? And I eventually said to him, you're going to have to tell me who you are. So that nearly disarmed him a little bit.
Yeah.
And then he told me and we just got chatting and I asked him how he was doing. And you can talk yourself out of many's a situation. Sometimes it's better, obviously, not to do that, to keep your head down, to try and remove yourself from where you are. And, you know, look, you just deal with every situation day by day as they come up. And it's not that regular, you know. You just have to be, I think, always a little bit alert when you're working. In the same way, look, as anybody who's working. I mean, these are people without morals, you know, without a compass in life. And you just have to be aware that if you're dealing with them in any way, they can turn on you or, you know, try to threaten you. They'd always be looking for your vulnerabilities, you know. Yeah. I would have find that sort of, you know, I remember being approached at one point by quite a veteran criminal, actually. But he liked to tell me what car I was driving. He'd obviously seen me somewhere, but he was trying to make out as if he knew a little bit more about me than he did.
I know where you live, kind of.
Exactly.
Thing, yeah.
So you just have to be very clear that you don't show any weaknesses like that. You have to, you know.
Yeah.
I knew he had probably just seen me in traffic, you know.
Yeah.
But
do some of them enjoy being in the papers, enjoy a bit of notoriety?
Well, you look, you they probably do. I mean, some of them describe the Sunday World as Hello magazine for the gangsters, you know, when they get in. Certainly the young guys, I think, in a way, their use of social media.
Yeah.
They will put up certain photographs of, you know, guys who are in jail will put up photographs on their Facebook site and they're all hoping to get into the papers. But some of them don't want to be there.
Do you worry that there's a danger of glorifying them and glorifying the lifestyle?
I would very much be concerned about that because you don't want to over sensationalize anyone or anything, and it's of no benefit to anybody to try and make a hero out of any of these people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there would be a lot of accusations. The tabloid newspapers do that. The Sunday World glorifies them, etc. I don't believe that's the case. I think we report and reflect what's actually happening out there. You know, usually they're pretty established by the time we're writing about them or certainly naming them. They would be very, very established criminals who... they mm-hmm. within that world, they would all know them anyway. So I don't think we're creating them
Do you have to do business with them as well in terms of getting stories and finding things out? Some of it obviously comes from them, doesn't it?
Most definitely, yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, absolutely. And in a way, that's an element that does really interest me in the job because I do think that we have a huge disconnect in this country. Middle class society, you know, when you're born, really, there's two really important things in your life. There's your postcode and your parents. And that will really determine largely what happens to you in the future, where you end up. And I think that a lot of us can just turn a blind eye to what's going on within our city and with people who are just born. You know, they just get a different hand of cards to you.
Yeah.
So I do find it. I find them interesting. I find a lot of times what they have to say has a point. Yeah. There was one guy in particular who always used to say to me, "Nicola, you know, the real criminals are in the Dáil. We're just making a few bob, you know." And you kind of go, okay, well, you know, that's an interesting point to make. And
yeah, apart from the fact of the murder and the mayhem and the violence.
Of course.
Yeah.
But yeah, so they, you know, you do have to deal with them and you have to talk to them and you have to try and work out. I think your responsibility is to work out why they're giving you the information, because, of course, they could be giving it. They're always going to have an agenda.
Yeah.
And you have to work out, firstly, the information is true. Secondly, what the agenda is. And then if you're OK with the agenda, good. But if the agenda is to have somebody murdered or, you know, something like that, then...
Okay, so there's some weird form of trust that you have to enter into, but it's a very careful one. You're fascinated, I know, by the women who are involved with these guys. Tell us a bit about them.
Yeah, I mean, the women are, there is just a God's amount of these women who are lining up to go out with these guys, to have children with them, to gain a place at the table. Women aren't very frequently the criminals. They're usually the partners. They don't really have a place. And yet some of them will establish themselves as criminals themselves. And God, they're tough. I mean, you talk about being a woman in a man's world. They are seriously tough. But the women are usually partners. There's usually a few women. So they'd be sharing a guy.
Okay.
And they have a place.
And the women are happy with that?
They accept it. They accept it. And, you know, it might cause a bit of a blow up, but then they'll be handed a few bob to go into town and buy a pair of shoes or whatever. And money will always satisfy them again. But they're looking for, most of them are looking to take themselves out of where they are, really, which can be, you know, they can be going nowhere. They're living in a working class area. They probably have no education. Their route to wealth is to grab a man that is a drug dealer. And that's the simple fact of it.
And status.
And then they can, you know, there's this idea that my man looks after me, and looking after you will mean gives you the money to, you know, buy the designer clothes, have a nice car, and they'll take the good with the bad. And the bad will obviously be that he might have another one down the road, or two or three.
I'm thinking of Carmela Soprano, which is a great portrayal of the kind of trade-offs that a woman can make. Listen, just before we finish up, you've written a few books. You've another one coming out in May. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, actually, that is a true story. That is a book that I've written in the voice of the individual. So it's I think it's going to connect with a lot of people. He's a young guy who was groomed into a drug gang, who got very, very heavily involved in it, and then who witnessed a murder, and he broke the omerta, which is that, you know, which rules that entire world, really. And he gave evidence and jailed people. Very interesting story, and one of the few, really, that I have been... Us journalists don't tend to like writing books because we don't have the patience for it. So, you know, it was one of the few stories I've come across in my time that I thought was worth.
Okay, and that's called The Witness, and it's out in May. Nicola Tallon, thank you very much, and we'll take a break.
The Weekend on One on RTE Radio 1.